Dr. Ernest Jones is a noted British physician and psychoanalyst. For the last 40 years of Sigmund Freud's life, Dr. Jones was his intimate companion and disciple. He has just finished publishing the third and last volume of a monumental labor of love, a biography of his master. And the completion of this biography, I think, affords us a fitting opportunity to think back and evaluate and appreciate the importance of the teachings and the findings of Dr. Freud for our day. For certainly, Sigmund Freud stands as one of the towering giants of the intellect in our 20th century. It was he who first taught to man that the diseases which ravage his body may be as much the product of his emotional and mental life as a physical disorder and maladjustment. He broached for us the frontier of the hidden world within, the unconscious world, and made us realize and recognize that there is much more that meets the eye when we judge the motivations of men than that which lies directly on the surface. Dr. Freud was born 101 years ago in the little Moravian village of Freiburg. His family was middle class, Jewish, and not overly prosperous. They were wool merchants, and when the new railroad through that part of the world bypassed the city of Freiburg, his father, Jacob, decided that economic well-being necessitated that they move elsewhere, and so the family traveled to Vienna when Freud was only 4 years of age. It was in that great city that Dr. Freud lived and studied and practiced and taught for almost 80 years. Indeed, he lived in Vienna till the very last year of his life, when the onrush of the Nazi hordes forced him to flee to a haven in England. Dr. Freud's youth was hardly what one would call well-rounded. Athletics, parties, society had almost no meaning in the upbringing of this lad. Indeed, I think to understand his upbringing, we have to understand the structure of Jewish life several generations ago. In the Jewries of those days, a family became established, became famous and sought after, if one of their young men could make a name for himself, could set a high mark in the world of Jewish scholarship and learning. These precocious youngsters were called Iluis, ones who could achieve greatness, who could rise to great heights. And if a family was fortunate enough to have such a precocious lad among their children, they gave them their head intellectually. They force-fed to them the bread of knowledge in an attempt to make them outshine and outdo all others in the fields of Jewish learning and Jewish scholarship. But to Dr. Freud's family, the world of the Jewish law and of the Talmud meant very little. But they sensed very early that they had such an Ilui, such a lad of tremendous potential in Freud, and they force-fed to him all the secular knowledge of philosophy and of science and of literature, which was part of the culture of Europe of their day. They saw that it lay on Freud's shoulders to establish their family, to make them something more than average. And Freud was given his head. Indeed, he was allowed to dominate the family circle. Alone of all the children, Dr. Freud enjoyed a room of his own. And perhaps the most illustrative story of all is one which tells us that when a sister of his showed particular talent with the piano, and when the family had saved enough money to buy her such an instrument, Freud, who was then in his eighth or ninth year, complained bitterly that her playing and practicing distracted his reading. And the very next day, the family returned the piano to the store, and this sister never once was able to practice or study this instrument which meant so much to her. The future of the family lay with Dr. Freud, Dr. Freud to be, and he was not to disappoint them. Dr. Freud's family, we have said, was Jewish. It was Jewish in a generation where Judaism was more a matter of label than of love. The family was one by one discarding the ancient disciplines of Jewish life. When they left Freiburg for the big city of Vienna, they stopped observing the dietary laws. His father, Jacob, as far as we know, never affiliated himself with any synagogue in this capital city, and probably was not even a high holiday Jew. No festivals were observed in Dr. Freud's home, with the exception of a perfunctory Seder meal which was held once a year. The father had undoubtedly received a good Jewish education. He was able to write Freud throughout his life Hebrew letters. Freud then must have had some Hebraic knowledge himself. But the sanctities of Jewish life, the piety of Jewish life, the worship and the loves which are part of our tradition, these had no meaning to the home in which Freud was born. And later, when he developed his philosophy and his theory, Dr. Freud was to lay little value on the organization and the structure of any formal religious creed. And yet Judaism had an ambivalent relationship to Freud. In the first place, it meant that he was discriminated against. There were certain occupations that he could not enter, certain circles where he was not welcome, certain colleges where he could not enroll. He knew from his earliest childhood the discriminations which were put against the Jew. And yet when Freud grew up into maturity, he realized that he had gained something from having been born, if only with the label Jew. In the first place, he had gained a certain love of learning, which was to stand him always in good stead. On his 70th birthday, he appeared before the B'nai B'rith organization in Vienna, the only Jewish organization with which he was ever to affiliate. And standing there, trying to evaluate his relationships to Judaism, he said quite plainly that he had little use for the God idea, or the form of prayer, or the religious observances of Jewish life. But he felt that the love of learning, the freedom of inquiry, which were basic to the Jewish milieu, had played a great role in developing the channels in which his life was to follow. And we are told that one day in his later life, a friend of his, Max Graf, came to him and said that he was thinking about having his young son convert to Christianity. He felt that he had showed tremendous promise. He wanted him to be able to go into the government service, where a brilliant future, he felt, was open to him if only he would convert. And Freud counseled Mr. Graf against such a policy. He said that he felt that the discipline of being Jewish, the fact that a young Jewish lad had to work twice as much and struggle twice as hard in order to achieve, was one of the most important factors in his development and in his maturity. It was, to quote him, a distinct advantage that I was Jewish, because I found that it forced me to fulfill my capacity and my capabilities, and I never regretted that prodding. So Freud sensed some of the values, at least inherent in our own traditions, love of learning. He sensed that it would be unworthy of him to try to escape the opprobrium and the restrictions which rested upon him as being Jewish. And yet the fact of his being Jewish preyed on him throughout his life. He felt that it restricted the development of the acceptance of his theories. Once at an international psychoanalytic congress in the early 1900s, where the men were discussing who should become the president of this Congress, Freud proposed that Dr. Carl Jung, a Swiss Protestant, should be its permanent head. His reasoning seems to have been that Dr. Jung being one of the few Protestant adherents and disciples whom he could number. His whole Vienna circle was Jewish. But Dr. Jung would give his theories stature in the eyes of the world. And psychoanalysis could no longer be dismissed offhand as a bit of high-pressure Jewish medical quackery. And when his Viennese disciples protested against naming Dr. Jung as permanent president, Sigmund Freud stormed into the room and apparently told them in quite plain language that their being Jewish was a detriment to the acceptance of psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic theory throughout the world, and that they, as Jews, must content themselves always with a second-rate role, the role of research and development. But to gain stature and publicity, they would have to find non-Jewish figureheads. His being Jewish determined the path that his life would take. Indeed, it seems as if fate conspired to make Freud achieve his destiny. A young summa cum laude graduate of the gymnasium could in Vienna look forward to a brilliant career in the law, at the universities, or in government service. Freud was such a summa cum laude graduate, but these doors were closed to him. Only in the profession of medicine could he find status and stature. And so it was to the Medical College of the University of Vienna that he applied and where he was enrolled. And then, fortunately, fate conspired again to interest Freud in the field where he was to make such significant contributions. At the end of his first year, when he seemed not to know into which area of medicine he should specialize, he became part of a class conducted by a very famous physiologist, Dr. Ernst Brücke. Dr. Brücke was chairman of the Laboratory of Physiological Research at the medical school. And apparently he was one of these unique personalities who could not only enlighten, but inspire. And Freud then stopped his medical education for 6 years. And he went to work as a laboratory technician and assistant in the workshop of Dr. Brücke. And here he worked side by side with this giant of Vienna medicine, who was studying the nervous systems of various fish and animals. And while the master was analyzing the physical structure of the spinal column and of the nervous system, Freud began to realize that not only must this nervous structure be understood, but that the whole dynamism of nervous disorder must be brought to light. And here, during these 6 years of laboratory research, he began to ask the questions which would later lead him to such great discovery. He finished medical school in 1885, and that summer he went to Paris, where he heard that a famous French physician and psychiatrist, Dr. Jean-Marie Charcot, was engaged in very important work on the nature of hysteria. Now, before Freud's day, the medical world generally believed that all emotional and mental disease was due to some form of physical disorder or malfunction. One experiment which Dr. Charcot had succeeded in carrying forth particularly intrigued Freud. It seems that Dr. Charcot had hypnotized some of his patients, and under hypnosis, he had been able to suggest to them that they were suffering all the normal disorders of an hysterical attack. And under this suggestion, these patients, which actually seemed to be suffering the semi-paralysis and the hysteria associated with this disease. This seemed to show to Freud proof of something he had long felt, that the diseases which rack our nervous system may be sometimes physically caused by physical disorder, but they can also be caused by emotional disorder and emotional maladjustment. He was faced now with a new problem, now that he realized that the older medical theories were outdated. If our emotional mental illness are as much caused by diseases of the mind and of our nervous systems as they are by physical causes, then how do we cure these diseases? How can we treat them? This was the problem to which Freud was forced to address himself. He returned to Vienna, puzzled over his problem, and began to engage in psychiatric practice. Fortunately, he was friendly with a very famous Viennese physician, Dr. Joseph Breuer. And this gentleman was one of those rare physicians who was not only highly skilled, but ingenious, an artist in medicine. And in one of their talks together, his older mentor told him of a young lady who had come into his office several years back complaining of temporary paralysis and of hysteric reactions. He told Freud of the unique treatment which he had applied to this young girl and of the success which he felt he had had with this treatment. He had put her to sleep through hypnosis, and then under hypnosis had suggested to her that she reveal to him the basic facts of her past emotional life. In so doing, she revealed to him certain traumatic experiences, certain emotional shocks which she had suffered. And when she was able to express and tell him and realize these hidden emotional trauma from her youth, she was cured. It seemed that the very expressing of these deep-seated, deep-rooted inner turmoils was enough to cure her of the manifestations of her mental illness. Dr. Breuer did not realize the full significance of his treatment, but this case of a girl known as Anna O must go down in medical history as the first case of a patient treated by some form of psychoanalysis. Freud recognized, as he listened to this case history, the germ of the idea which was to grow into his psychoanalytic theory. Mental disorder, mental illness, certain types, he came to realize, could be cured by catharsis, by enabling the individual to express his hidden fears, his hidden traumatic experiences, and things which we hide even from ourselves, which lie deeply buried and highly censored in our innermost souls. Dr. Freud was to dedicate his life to the refinement of the techniques which were suggested by this first form of psychoanalytic therapy. His free-wheeling mind, his highly fertile imagination, was to apply these techniques and this theory not only to medical therapy, to the treatment of many a form of mental illness, but he was to be able to structure and organize a whole theory of the unconscious life of man, this life which lies so deeply buried inside our breasts. He was to develop for us a wholly new language to express the dynamic nature of mental disease, the interrelationships between the unconscious which lies within and our conscious selves. Familiar words such as ego and id and libido, transference, sublimation, and the like were all forged in his mind. It was he who brought light into the world within, into the world of the unconscious. And in so doing, he made us recognize and realize many an important truth. He made the medical profession recognize that they must treat the whole man, not only his physical being. They made us recognize and realize that we must not judge hastily, that very often the actions which we observe have deep-seated causes which we must learn to recognize and to treat. For instance, he made us realize that reading problems in our children may not be due to the ineptitude of a teacher or the lack of ability of the pupil, but to some troubling personal and emotional maladjustment in the child. He made us recognize that the sheer destructiveness of an adolescent may not be due to simply willful spite, but may be due to some highly tense pressures developing within the adolescent, which he needs to express, and which he can find no other way so to do. It is not easy for us in this generation, since Dr. Freud has taught, to judge arbitrarily the motivations. And certainly each of us learned in his own life discipline to search out the hidden causes as much as we can, to try to correct these as well as to judge the action by and of itself. Dr. Freud was to teach us a great deal about the role of civilization in channeling the basic drives of man into constructive and valuable enterprises. He was to teach us a great deal about the meaning of our dreams, the so-called slips of the tongue, which revealed to us something, at least, of our hidden inner lives. And throughout 83 years of activity and teaching, Dr. Freud was to each year bring to our attention the implications of his theories to any and all of the very disciplines of our lives. Never again will the world be what it was before he began to teach. The problems which face us, we realize, are now much more complex than we had ever dreamt. We must not only solve our social and economic and political problems, we must somehow find the means of solving effectively the problems of personal growth, of helping a child grow into an adult without having deep-seated torments which will frustrate him throughout his life. But above all, Freud brought to our world a great blessing of healing, because until his day, those who suffered from certain mental illnesses could hope for no therapy. And his method of psychoanalysis has brought to them cure and health and rehabilitation. But I think that we must always bear in mind certain critical reservations as we read his teachings and try to apply them in our lives. The first reservation, which I think we must always make, was observed by a noted American psychoanalyst, Dr. Harry Stack Sullivan. He mentioned once that one of the greatest drawbacks to the spread of psychiatric theory was the widespread claims to omniscience, which were often made by the psychiatrist and by the psychoanalyst. And he reminded us, and I quote him here, that psychiatry is still more of an art than of a science. Psychiatry and psychoanalysis are forms of mental therapy designed to relieve those who are emotionally distraught and emotionally ill. It is not a panacea for all the anxieties and tensions of daily living. Unfortunately, some have been overly hasty in running to the analyst to solve their minor unhappiness, their minor disorders, their minor tensions. They have forgotten that therapy is as much a shock to the human body as is a major surgical operation, that its form cannot always be predicted, and that it should be undertaken only after competent medical advice has been secured, and only when it is required. We are still adults. We must each and every one of us cope with the problems and tensions of daily living. And only when these tensions grow beyond that which we are capable as adults of solving, only then should we turn to the physician, the mind or of the soul, in order to secure help from without. The second observation I think that I should like to make is that we should not broadly apply the theories and the philosophies of Freud and of his disciples into our daily lives without critically evaluating all of their implications. I feel that our age has been overly hasty in such application. Freud taught us a great deal about the evils of repression, about the tensions that grow within when our basic instincts are thwarted. It's almost as if we had a pressure cooker within. And when the world in which we live or the family in which to which we are born thwarts the expression of these natural drives, they never cease building up pressure within. And sometimes this pressure simply bursts out in uncontrollable action. Some men and women generalized from this that in the fields of education and child rearing, all those authorities, all those disciplines which restrict the child, which force him to stay within certain bounds, should be done away with, should be abolished. Some schools were talked into adopting programs of education which dealt with the child untrammeled, which spoke of the natural development of the child. And they discarded all the traditional disciplines of education, even sometimes the disciplines of grammar and of spelling and of good taste. They did not want to thwart the child, to force upon him any goals, any values, which were not basically and intrinsically his. But unfortunately, the over-hasty application of this theory was not altogether successful. Test after test has been run on the graduates of these advanced progressive schools, and time and again it has been shown that they have not had built in within themselves sufficient self-discipline, sufficient power of concentration, sufficient reverence for the fact to lead and to develop successful lives. Freudian theory taught us a great deal about recognizing the tensions which exist in the handicapped child, in the retarded child, in the emotionally disturbed child. And education owes a great deal to his teachings. But the over-hasty application of a broad theory to the broadest principles of religious, of educational discipline did not bring the relief, the success that was hoped for. What was true of education was true also of child raising. We all know of advanced homes where permissiveness reigns supreme, apparently sanctioned by psychiatric Freudian theory. The word no almost disappeared from these homes. They were afraid of thwarting the natural desires and needs of the child. And children grew up undisciplined, chaotic in mind, in dress, in habit. Dr. William B. Terhune, a noted physician, child psychologist on the Pacific Coast, observed that most of the young children who have grown up under such an advanced atmosphere show themselves to be more prone to emotional disorder, less able to adapt successfully to our society, than those children who were raised under the stabler and perhaps sterner homes of a past generation. When we were overly hasty in ingesting this new wisdom, when we were overly hasty in applying it to the time-honored disciplines of our lives, it did not always avail us. And we found that the time-honored and time-tested discipline of all ages was sometimes and in some ways superior to the new wisdom and the new discipline of our age. I think a word too should be said about some of the implications which have been made as to the relevance of Freudian philosophy to our social thinking. Ours is an age of increased urbanization, increased world tension, increased prosperity, increased population, an age where, if anything, we needed to reinforce the moral fabric of our day. And yet I am afraid that the widespread popularity of semi-understood Freudian theories has done just the reverse and has weakened our moral integrity and our moral fiber. It has become popular to blame our parents for misraising us, our schools for misinforming us, our peer groups for misleading us, but never ourselves. This philosophy has given us an armory of ready-made rationalizations and excuses for our weaknesses. We blame our parents. We blame our schools. We blame the rivalries within our homes. We blame our society. We blame every person but the person who should be blamed for our examples of personal weakness, of our choosing the evil above the good, and the weak above the strong, and the cowardly above the courageous. We no longer blame ourselves, because we have been conditioned to look for the causes of our action rather than to look on the objective reality of that which we do. And this popularization of Freudian thought has also led to a sullying and a dirtying of the sanctified heroisms of human life. We have psychoanalyzed the prophet. We claim today that he is simply a neurotic, acting out some personal maladjustment, rather than a man who senses the will of God and cannot contain himself but must express the truth. We psychoanalyze the social critic, the rebel, and the revolutionary. And we forget that they may actually be complaining and staking their lives about the existence of certain social evils which must be eradicated. And we claim that they are simply acting out their will for power, the needs to have their egos adulated and satisfied. We have psychoanalyzed the martyr. He is no longer a man who is staking his life, his very being, on his belief in the truth, but he is a deeply ill person with a deeply seated need for self-immolation. We have destroyed the effectiveness of those who would lead us out of our world tensions by suspecting all too soon, all too frequently, all too superficially their motives. We no longer look at the objective reality of that which they are stating to us, but judge them ad hominem, by their personalities, by their motivations, hidden though these may be from us. But when these reservations have been made, and when we have resolved critically to evaluate the theories of these masters of psychoanalysis and psychiatry, of which Freud stands paramount, I think we must recognize the deep gratitude which we feel to them for healing, for cure, for enlightenment, for revealing to us a world which we had suspected but which we had never understood, for making us conscious of the importance of these theories in almost all the disciplines of life. And if we say to them, go slowly, do not try and reverse and do away with time-honored disciplines until you are sure all of the effects of your teachings in the society of men, it is not to say that their suggestions are unwanted, or their insights unfounded. It's merely to say that they are still a young, burgeoning medical skill. They have still to refine and to define their own intellectual basis, because after all, there are as many psychoanalytic theories as there are warring religious sects. It is to say that cooperatively and together, in the years ahead, we can work towards making this world a finer, more wonderful place in which to live. And I think we as Jews can take special pride in the contributions of Dr. Freud. For even though he never found it within himself to affiliate with our traditional beliefs, never did he subscribe to our God, he yet found that the soil of Judaism in which he was nurtured, our love of learning, our willingness to allow man's mind to freely course to and fro throughout the world, asking any question which needs to be asked, developing any theory which looks promising. This love of learning This freedom of inquiry has given many a great man to our age. It is perhaps no happenstance that the great of science, of medicine, in our 20th century, have been to a large extent born into this atmosphere. We can only pray that we can continue this love of learning, this willingness to follow the interests of our mind wherever they may lead us in our own lives, and give it as a sure inheritance unto our children. Dr. Freud, we owe our thanks, and to his teachings, we owe our attention and our critical respect. Amen.